talk a little bit about the religious climate in the New England colonies and pointed out that they had a developing problem. Remember, we talked about the visible and invisible church. The visible church is the model that they worked with. The invisible church is an idea that Calvin put forward, that there is a church that exists in heaven, or that is named in heaven. God keeps the books for the invisible church, and that it can't be seen on the earth. The visible manifestation of the church on the earth is an imperfect manifestation. Well, the New England colonies assumed that there was a visible church, and that everybody that was associated with their congregation was expected to be of a certain type. And that association with a congregation did not depend upon baptism. The association with a particular congregation depended largely on whether you had presented your conversion narrative and it had been accepted by the members of a local congregation. Now, there was that's not the only thing that was associated with being part of visible church. You did need to experience salvation. You did need to have baptism. And it membership in the visible church in New England granted you a lot of rights. You had the rights that are associated with church membership. You could take the Lord's Supper. You could present your children to be baptized, much as you had been presented to be baptized as a child. And there were civic rights that were associated with being a part of a church. If you weren't a part of the church, if you hadn't signed on to that covenant and presented your conversion narrative and it had been accepted, then you couldn't vote. You couldn't do a lot of things that were a part of what we think of as civic rights. In the New England colonies, there was a very close tie between the church and the state. So they had a problem. There were all of these people that had been baptized by their parents, first generation Puritans, who had baptized their children, but their children had never presented a conversion narrative and they'd never accepted the covenant. And then when their children were born, because they had never presented their conversion narrative and they had never signed on to the covenant, their children could not be presented for baptism. So this is a...
What year are you talking about?
The early 1600s.
1600. All right. Thank you.
So it kind of is a generational problem. Not everybody got there at the same point because, you know, you had young people, old people, that kind of thing. But it's a problem that begins to manifest itself primarily with the third generation. Second generation, they had already been baptized, but they had never signed on to the covenant. And so their children are the ones that are really in question. And from the perspective of the churches, they were outside of the discipline of the church because they'd never become a part of the church. And they couldn't own land. They couldn't vote. There were all kinds of things that they couldn't, that those children couldn't do. So they had to come up with some way to deal with these unconverted people. That the unconverted people they're trying to deal with is that big group in the second generation. So what they came up with was the halfway covenant. And the halfway covenant said that you could present those, your children, if you were second generation, you could present your children to be baptized, even though you weren't. So it's a halfway covenant. You were kind of given some religious rights because they had to find a way to deal with this problem. So this is 1662 when the synod in Massachusetts passes this advisory that's called the halfway covenant. They didn't mandate it on churches. It was just an advisory. So this is 1662. The problem continues to grow. And this is what we talked about last week. The propositions concerning the subject of baptism and the consociation of churches, who was a part of the church, collected and confirmed out of the word of God by a synod of elders and messengers of the churches in Massachusetts colony in New England, assembled at Boston the year 1662. Okay. Now, this was defended heavily by a minister named Stoddard, and I was trying to remember his first name. I can't remember his first name, but Stoddard is a staunch supporter of the halfway covenant. His grandson is Jonathan Edwards. In fact, Jonathan Edwards followed his grandfather as a minister in Northampton. But because Jonathan Edwards did not support the halfway covenant, they fired him. So, Jonathan Edwards eventually preached a famous sermon. He wrote a lot of stuff. And to really get the flavor of Jonathan Edwards, you need to read some of his other stuff that he wrote. This one is impressive and sounds in some ways very harsh. But Jonathan Edwards believed in the concept of grace. And if you read just this sermon, you kind of come away from it thinking he does not buy into the notion of grace very much at all. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God is a harsh treatise. And it was directed at that second generation. In fact, the very beginning of his sermon, I don't know if you had a chance to read this, and it is hard to read because it is a transcription of exactly what he said. And so you have to, if you'll read it out loud, it'll make more sense. And even at that, you have to kind of read it with an understanding of the flowery nature of their language. And they talked in long, long sentences with all kinds of subordinate clauses, drives you nuts trying to figure out what he's saying. But this is the way, it's kind of like the King James translation. King James translation sometimes has a sentence that'll go on for half a page. And you have a hard time figuring out exactly who the subject of the sentence is. Well, this sermon is that way. But you have to understand, first and foremost, this is a sermon that's preached to the second generationers. That's the That's the group that Jonathan Edwards would call the unconverted. See, they had been baptized as babies, but they had never presented their conversion story and become a part of a local congregation. So when you read this, just remember, Jonathan Edwards, when he talks to the unconverted, he's not talking to people who don't know anything about God. Jonathan Edwards is talking to those second generationers who had been baptized but never submitted themselves or their conversion narrative to the acceptance of the local congregation. And you have to remember, in Massachusetts, about 80% of the churches subscribe to this covenant theory. 80% of the churches were Puritan churches. They were Congregationalists. So it wasn't as if you had a plethora of different denominations. It didn't look like the situation looks like in Eugene at all. You just had one church in the town, and everybody had to attend. So, questions at this point. I'd like to go through this sermon and point out the 10, what does he call them? 10 considerations that Edwards lays out. And then after he lays out his 10 considerations, if you've read the sermon, then he gets to the application section. And apparently Edwards was a fiery speaker. One person said he dangled his hearers over the fires of hell. And at one point he talked about them dangling over the fires of hell as if they were a giant rock that was held up by just a spider's web. And at the least moment, God could cut them loose. During the course of his sermon, the people that were there reported that there were cries from the audience. What shall we do? Yeah, remind you of what was going on in Acts 2. But it's a very different kind of sermon. Now, I said this is a seminal sermon because in this sermon, and we'll talk about this next week, Jonathan Edwards breaks with a traditional view of Calvinism. And he starts to talk about how men and their will is involved in the whole process of salvation. A Calvinist would never preach this sermon. Jonathan Edwards thinks they need to go back to Calvin's theories, but he doesn't want to go all the way back to Calvin's theories. And so this sets the stage for a lot of what happens in the colonies. And this is why, because this sort of sets the stage for a lot of what happened. This is why when we talk about Tulip and a refutation of Calvin's theories, we're kind of talking to a group that doesn't really exist in America. And I'll try to point that out next week. We'll talk about the difference between Calvinism and Arminianism. We don't talk about Arminianism very often, and we really should, because Arminianism is or a modified version of Calvinism is more common than a Calvinist position. Wesley. I'm terrible at remembering their first names.
John Wesley.
Was it John Wesley?
Yeah.
And Stoddard was Samuel.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So Samuel Stoddard, who supported the halfway covenant, his grandson is Jonathan Edwards. And that halfway covenant is what caused him to preach this sermon. So he has to argue against the halfway covenant. Okay, so he has 10 considerations in the course of this sermon. And a lot of these, the way it's worded, you have to be very careful to make sure, because you might listen to his consideration and say, well, I agree with that. You might agree with it and you might not, because he doesn't always mean the same thing by words that you mean. When he talks about the unconverted, he's talking about people who've been baptized, but they've never presented themselves or their conversion narrative, and they've never signed on to the covenant. So just be very careful as you read through this sermon. 10 considerations. First, God may release wicked men into hell at any given moment. And look at the way he says that. God releases them into hell. He doesn't put them into hell. But the only thing that's keeping them out of hell is the providential care of God and the gracious provision of God. It's as if they're walking down the trail that goes along the rim of the Grand Canyon. And this trail that they're walking on is exceptionally thin. But God is going to put his hand out and help them stay on the trail. But at any moment, he could remove his hand and they will fall.
Say, Dean, what does he base that on?
Well, you have to read the entirety of his discussion. But a lot of it is Psalms, Deuteronomy, specifically. This one is based on Psalm 73:18. This is a man that walks in a slippery place. So Psalm 73:18, I think it's an abuse of Psalm 73:18, but that's what he based it on. If that's on page 4. Of the sermon itself. They are always exposed to destruction as one that walks or stands in slippery places is always exposed to fall. Does that answer your question? Everything he says, he bases on a statement of scripture, but I think he misuses the scriptures.
I think you hit the nail on the head.
Okay.
Because he's adding his own version to the scriptures.
Well, that's true. And what that tells me is we have to be very careful when we read a statement in the Bible, that we make sure that we apply it the way that it was supposed to be applied. the way that it was applied by the writer. You know, Calvin based what he said on biblical statements. I think he misapplied the biblical statements, but this is the way he begins. God can release men into hell at any given moment. Second, the wicked deserve to be released into hell. Now, remember who he's talking about when he talks about the wicked. He's not talking about those that are completely divorced from the church, devoid of any knowledge. That's who I would think of when I talk about the wicked. But that's not who Jonathan Edwards is talking about. He's talking about second generationers who were in his audience, but they had never presented their conversion narrative. They had never signed on to the church covenant. The wicked deserve to be released into hell. Divine justice does not prevent God from allowing the destruction of the wicked at any moment. Now, if you were an absolute Calvinist, a la John Calvin, you would not say that. God does not, in Calvin's mind, allow the destruction of the wicked. He predestines the destruction of the wicked. Okay. Number three. The wicked at this very moment, and again, these are people that are associated with churches. They're the backbenchers. They're the unconverted. They suffer under God's condemnation to hell at this very moment. So that's one of the reasons why the Salem witch trials happened. Our crops are failing. Our colony is in trouble. It's because the wicked people are bringing this upon us. They are suffering. And because they're suffering, because God is allowing them to suffer, it's slopping over onto us. Like I said, this whole sermon seems really harsh. Questions?
Dean?
Yeah.
I just had one question. Back where they were talking about children, did they do infant baptism?
Yes.
They did?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. When a member of the church had a baby, they presented that baby for baptism. If you were a first generationer, you could present your child for baptism. That child would have been a second generationer. But remember, second generationer had a baby, they could not present that baby for baptism.
Dean?
Yeah.
You bring up another question with that, and that is, were they rebaptized for the forgiveness of their sins when they became of age?
No. No. They would present their conversion narrative. And that's how they were added to the visible church. Their notion of baptism is completely different than the notion of baptism that I would teach.
Thank you.
Remember what we said. Baptism does not add you to the visible church. You look like you had a comment, Ralph.
No.
Okay. Now, some of the reasons for them presenting their children for baptism was that they believed that the sin of Adam was laid upon the child at birth. That's a doctrine of original sin. And we'll see next week how Jonathan Edwards reinterprets this doctrine of original sin. So remember what I said. Edwards is coming out of a dark place. And he's coming into the light. He's beginning to realize some things that are very important. And he's realizing that he can't support the old Calvinist doctrine. He doesn't want to go to the halfway covenant, but he realizes he can't support the old Calvinist doctrine. So he forges a new pathway. And, you know, on one hand, I can fault him for not coming all the way into the light. But at the same time, I have to say he came a long way. And he didn't get to where maybe in the Second Awakening people started to get, but he made a lot of progress. Okay. Fourth consideration. The wicked on earth at this very moment. Now remember who the wicked are. That's the unconverted second generationers who haven't signed on to the covenant, suffer a sample of the torments of hell. At this very moment, the wicked must not think simply because they are not physically in hell that God, in whose hand the wicked now reside, is not at this very moment, do not bear the fierceness of his wrath. That was a bad sentence, and I don't know how to exactly correct it.
Wasn't it this consideration, and of course we haven't gone through all 10 of them yet, but this one that kind of gave rise to the Salem witch trials?
Yeah, this one and the third one.
Yeah. Yeah, because they had to purge themselves of the people who they thought were among those wicked.
Right. If you have this notion of the visible church,
mm-hmm.
you can't let anybody into the visible church. Nobody can be a part of the visible church who is not a converted person.
Which is also your community. It's your civic thing as well as the religious piece of it.
Yes.
So that's where it spills over.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Fifth consideration. At any moment God shall permit him, Satan stands ready to fall upon the wicked and seize them as his own. The old Calvinist position says God throws them into hell. This new position that Edwards is forging says Satan is waiting to grab you, and he will. God just stops holding Satan off. Number six. If it were not for God's restraints, there are in the souls of wicked men hellish principles reigning, which presently would kindle and flame out into hellfire. So within this group of people, there are hellish desires that could immediately flame up and consume them.
Dean?
Yeah.
Well, this sort of, I don't know. It feels like it sort of puts the responsibility on God to restrain these people rather than the responsibility being on those people. I mean, it's like God's only keeping you from being thrown in the fire. I don't know. It just doesn't sound quite right to me.
Well, I would agree with you, but remember, he's coming out of a Calvinist philosophy that says God is sovereign, man does nothing as far as his own salvation is concerned. God must place in you a regenerate spirit before the gospel would even appeal to you.
Thank you.
So you're exactly right. He's putting a lot of responsibility on God, but not as much as a traditional Calvinist would. Okay. Other question. Don't get me wrong. I'm not defending this sermon. It's just you have to understand this sermon and understand the changes that they were making before you can understand the second Great Awakening, which was a response to the situation that they created. Simply because there are not means. Excuse me. Go ahead. Somebody had a question. No. Okay. Number seven, simply because there are not visible means of death before them at any given moment, the wicked should not feel secure. Now, again, this is a response to the eternal security of the elect, which is a part of Calvinist doctrine. Number eight, simply because it is natural to care for oneself or to think that others may care for them, men should not think themselves safe from God's wrath. nothing you can do prevents God from withdrawing his hand and letting you slip off that path that you are on. In fact, he calls it the mere pleasure of God. Now, when he talks about the mere pleasure of God, I think he's talking about the notion of grace. I mean, that language, the mere pleasure of God, would kind of make you think that God is up there, is up in heaven with a huge fly swatter. And at any given moment, he gets tired of you. And he just says, I'm tired of Lenny, let him go. The pleasure is kind of like the way that the Hebrew writer uses the way that our parents discipline us after their own pleasure. It doesn't mean that they took pleasure in spanking us. It means that they did what seemed best to them. So man is only able to stay on that slippery path because of the mere pleasure of God.
I'll put on my human resources hat. It's the same way that we use the term pleasure when we talk about the executives in a city government, in a government. You serve at the pleasure of the city manager.
Right.
So if, you know, at any time, the city manager could have let me go. I was not represented by a union. I was an executive, and I served at the pleasure of the city manager. And it's not because she was capricious, and it's not because she was arbitrary in her decisions. It's because she had to look at what she saw as best for the organization that she had to run. So it's the same. It's used in the same way. So that you serve at the, it's kind of like you, that this is done at God's pleasure, at what he sees best.
Right.
So it's the same use of the word. That's the thing that came to my HR brain.
Yeah, but that, I mean, this, like I said, this sermon seems really harsh. And the sermon apparently lasted for somewhere between 3 and 4 hours. So if you ever got a talking to from your parents, this was the worst talking to that ever came down the pike. Number 9, all that wicked men may do to save themselves from hell's pains shall afford them nothing if they continue to reject Christ. Again, that doesn't sound terribly foreign to what you would hear me preach. I'm not sure that he means the same thing by it. Especially when you start reading the applications. And when you read the editor's notes at the end of the sermon, the text that I sent you contains the sermon and the editor's notes. So read the editor's notes as well, because they kind of put the sermon into a broader context. It's hard to take a single sermon and say that's what somebody believes, but the editor's notes put it into a broader context. And then number 10, again, This is the preservation of the wickedness, the preservation of the elect. God never promised to save us from hell except for those contained in Christ through the covenant of grace. Now, what he means by the covenant of grace is probably different than what you would mean if you were talking about the covenant of grace. When they use the term covenant, they used it in a very different sense. They go back to the Old Testament a lot as they talk about the idea of covenant. That's why one of the sermons that was, again, a seminal sermon in the Second Great Awakening was a sermon that Alexander Campbell preached on the distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament. That got him into a lot of trouble with the Baptists when he said there's a distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, you might look at that and say, well, everybody knows that, but not everybody did at that time. Not everybody thought about that. God has never promised to save us from hell. That's the preservation of the elect, except for those contained in Christ through the covenant of grace. Okay. Talked about a lot of stuff. Next week, we're going to talk about this big chart. And I'll send this chart out to everyone so that you'll have it, but we're not going to have time to get into it tonight. I knew that we couldn't do all of this at the same time. So I'll send this chart out. It's a comparison of traditional Calvinism on the, when I look at my screen, it's on the right, and Arminianism. And you have to understand, Jonathan Edwards is somewhere between Arminianism and Calvinism. But he's not going back to traditional Calvinism. And Wesley doesn't go back to traditional Calvinism. So that's all important to understand when you talk to someone about Calvinist principles. Understand, most people don't believe that. Most people that you're going to come in contact with do not believe Calvinist principles the way Calvin laid out Calvinist principles. They're somewhere in between Arminianism and Calvinism. And it's just called, Arminianism because one of the foremost proponents of this view was Joseph Arminian. And it is also sometimes called Pelagianism. Calvinism is sometimes called Augustinianism. Augustine and Pelagius had the conflict a long time before Calvin ever came on the scene. So we'll talk about those things next week and how this movement is slowly moving away from Calvinism and how that lays the foundation for the Second Great Awakening to move even farther away from Calvinism, much closer to Arminianism. Questions? Comments?
I think it's hard for me to lose sight of the fact that God always had a remnant of people. So there were always people that were that were structured as the New Testament church. And people went far afield. And then these are incremental baby steps to kind of get back to looking at the New Testament as a guide for what God intended the church to be and what God intended for our relationship to be with him. And so when we study stuff like this, I tend to forget, I don't know if other people do too, but I tend to forget that there have always been people who were faithful to God and looked at the scriptures and to get their information, not to Calvin, not to Stoddard, not to, you know, all these people, but look to the scriptures. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's really important that we not lose sight of that. And I have a hard time with that because I do think that this was the majority of people and the majority of people in this country at that time, in the established part of this country at that time.
Well, you got to remember way back when there were a lot of people that were illiterate.
Exactly.
And they couldn't read, so they depended on these powerful preachers who dissuaded them to go the wrong way.
Right, exactly.
That's a good point.
As sad as it is. Yep.
That's a good point. And I'm one who is disturbed by the fact that we are developing a generation of kids who don't know how to read very well. And because they don't know how to read, they find the New Testament in just about any translation very difficult to read. And, you know, a lot of people have suggested that that's a good argument for churches making sure that people know how to read. Mm-hmm. That was, in essence, the reason why Yale and Princeton and Harvard, all of the major colleges that came out of this movement started.
Mm-hmm. As Christian education. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And look how far they've come.
Yeah, it morphed.
As a path of truth.
It morphed into something else.
Completely. Now it's anti-Christian.
A lot.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting, though, because I love the history because it's we have to remember that this is incremental changes. And I have to, like, applaud these people for making some change and challenging themselves and challenging the people who listen to them to make change. And so, you know, we're making progress through history, but it seems painfully slow because we people are very slow to change.
And it's really interesting to me that Stoddard and his bunch, the group that advocated for the halfway covenant, they're called the New Lights. And Jonathan Edwards, his bunch is called the Old Lights.
Hmm.
Because they wanted to move back closer to Calvinism. They didn't want to go all the way back, but they wanted to move closer to Calvinism.
And the thing is, they're only two generations apart.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Edwards' defense of Calvinism is very different than John Calvin's defense of Calvinism.
Hmm. Interesting.
But just it's fascinating to read this stuff. And I know it's, you know, I'm the kind of guy who sits and reads all the time. And that Kim tells me that could be my fatal flaw. But it's important for us, I think, to understand where this stuff comes from. Hey, we've got this all in an hour. Amazing. I wasn't sure we would be able to do this. And I'm not sure we'll be able to get everything in next week in an hour. But we will try. We'll